This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Imagine sitting in a courtroom in Van Nuys, California on a Friday morning in April 2025. The fluorescent lights buzz faintly overhead, and everyone in the room knows they're witnessing a moment that, in any other case, might have been routine. Just another hearing on a busy docket. But this one isn't routine, not even close. This one is about Eric and Lyle Menendez. And after decades behind bars for one of the most infamous double homicides in American history, they're suddenly back on the legal radar, facing the possibility, however slim, that they might not die in prison after all. So here's what happened. On April 11th, Superior Court Judge Michael Jesic shut down a last-minute attempt by Los Angeles District Attorney Nathan Hochman to yank away the one thread of hope the Menendez brothers have been holding onto for over a year. The possibility of a resentencing hearing. It's a legal proceeding that could, under California law, change their life without parole sentences into something that opens the door, just barely, for a parole hearing. Not a guarantee of freedom, but a seat at the table. And for Eric and Lyle, that's more than they've had in nearly 30 years. Hochman had tried to kill the process before it even got rolling. In a lengthy motion, he argued that the previous DA, George Gascon, had filed for resentencing under a policy he didn't agree with. Gascon, known for his progressive criminal justice reforms, had proposed the brothers be resentenced to 50 years to life, which would make them parole eligible by now. But Hochman, who took office in 2024, came in with a different mission and a very different opinion about what justice looks like in this case. So, in a move that shocked exactly no one, he filed a motion to withdraw Gascon's request. But the judge wasn't buying it. Jesic's decision on April 11th wasn't a declaration that the Menendez brothers deserve freedom. It wasn't even a ruling on whether their sentence should be reduced. It was just the court saying, we're not going to skip the process. The hearing will happen April 17th and 18th, right back in that same Van Nuys courtroom. And for the Menendez brothers, that's a seismic shift in a case that, until recently, seemed frozen in time. Now picture the scene. Eric and Lyle Menendez, both in their 50s now, appearing via video from prison. They're wearing matching blue prison jumpsuits, sitting side by side, something we haven't seen since the mid-90s. They've spent most of their incarceration in separate facilities, rarely in contact. But here they are, silent on screen, listening in real time as a courtroom debates their fate. For a lot of people watching, it's a surreal image. These aren't the clean-cut, tearful boys from the early trials. These are middle-aged men who've spent more than half their lives behind bars, watching the world move on without them. Inside the courtroom, things got tense fast. Prosecutors came out swinging, dragging in a slideshow of graphic crime scene photos. Photos from that now infamous August night in 1989 when Jose and Kitty Menendez were shotgunned to death in their Beverly Hills mansion. They called the brothers' defense a bunker of lies. They leaned hard into the original narrative. Two spoiled rich kids who murdered their parents out of greed, then spent their trust fund money on Rolex watches and Porsches before finally getting caught. The implication was clear. Nothing has changed. Don't be fooled by prison time and graying hair. But the defense had their own message, and it was aimed squarely at the judge. And let's be honest, the public. They didn't deny the crime. They didn't rewrite history. But they did argue that context matters. That what we know now, thanks to recent revelations, paints a very different picture of why these murders happened. And more importantly, they argued that the attempt to cancel the hearing wasn't about justice at all. It was about politics, about a new DA trying to make an example out of a case that was already controversial and emotionally loaded. Defense attorney Mark Garagos, who's been with the Menendez brothers for years now, didn't hold back. He accused the prosecution of turning the courtroom into a dog and pony show, saying the crime scene photos were paraded around for theatrical effect, not legal substance. And he thanked the judge for what he called a decision rooted in law, not political gamesmanship. It's worth stepping back for a second here, because no matter how you feel about the Menendez brothers, whether you believe they were abused children pushed to the brink or cold-blooded killers who plotted their parents' deaths to unlock an inheritance, this resentencing hearing matters, not because it guarantees anything, but because it reopens the door to a legal system that had, for a long time, closed it shut. See, California law has changed in recent years. There's been a broader reckoning with how the state sentences people who were very young at the time of their crimes. Back in 1989, Lyle was 21 and Eric was 18. Under newer laws, courts are required to consider youth, trauma, and potential for rehabilitation when reviewing life without parole sentences for offenders under 26. That's the lane the Menendez brothers are trying to travel down now. It doesn't mean automatic release, but it does mean the court has to take a second look. The April hearing is that second look, and it's not just procedural, it's symbolic. For years, the Menendez case has lived in this strange space, part legal history, part tabloid obsession, part true crime Netflix binge. But now it's back where it began. In a courtroom, under oath, with real stakes. And those stakes aren't just for Eric and Lyle, they're for a justice system that's wrestling with the complicated legacy of tough-on-crime policies from the 80s and 90s, and a public that's become more open to the idea that trauma, especially in youth, might deserve more legal weight than it used to get. No one's pretending this is simple. The victims in this case were real people. Jose and Kitty Menendez died violently and brutally, and their deaths shattered an entire family. But the question now, 3 decades later, is whether justice is a fixed point or something that can evolve as more information comes to light. The resentencing hearing will dive into that question. The judge will listen to arguments, consider the brothers' prison records, their behavior, the new evidence of abuse, and the evolving understanding of how trauma affects decision-making, especially in young adults. And at the end of it all, he'll decide whether Eric and Lyle Menendez should get a different sentence, one that still holds them accountable, but gives them a possible path toward release. It's not parole, it's not a pardon, it's not clemency, it's just a hearing. But for two men who've spent more than 30 years waiting for a second chance to tell their side of the story, it's everything. The ink had barely dried on the calendar setting the April resentencing hearing when Hochman filed an 88-page motion in March 2025 that can only be described as a full-force legal takedown. His position? The Menendez brothers don't deserve a resentencing hearing. Not now, not later, not ever. According to Hochman, this entire process shouldn't just be paused. It should be reversed. He argued that the petition filed under former DA George Gascon was flawed from the start and that it sent the wrong message, that if you say the right things long enough, you can outwait a life sentence. Hochman's motion didn't tiptoe around the brothers' defense narrative. He went straight for the jugular, calling their long-standing claims of childhood sexual abuse a fabrication. In his view, this wasn't a case of two boys pushed to a psychological breaking point. It was cold. It was premeditated, and it was motivated, he argued, by money and resentment, not fear or trauma. Hochman's language in the court filings was blunt. Until the brothers fully recognize, acknowledge, and accept complete responsibility, they are not eligible for leniency under any resentencing law. Translation: unless they stop talking about abuse and start admitting they killed their parents purely for personal gain, there's no room for compromise. It's a sharp contrast from Gascon's position, which leaned heavily into the evolving science around trauma and youth brain development. Gascon's office had argued that even if the crime was horrific, the law now required the court to consider who the defendants were at the time, young men barely out of adolescence who may have acted under the long-term effects of abuse. But Hochman has taken a hard pivot. For him, it's not just about whether someone has been in prison for 30-plus years. It's about whether they've shown what he considers true rehabilitation. And that starts with owning up fully to the original crime without the self-defense storyline. And Hochman isn't just making legal arguments. He's framing this fight as one of principle. In press statements and interviews, he's pushed back hard against any narrative that he's being overly punitive or political. He said repeatedly that this isn't about undoing reforms for the sake of optics. It's about upholding accountability. If someone continues, in his words, to build their defense around lies of self-defense, they're not rehabilitated, they're rehearsed. That framing has sparked a lot of pushback. Critics, especially those following this case closely, have accused Hochman of playing politics with people's lives. They point to the fact that Hochman rode into office promising to reverse many of Gascon's decisions, particularly around resentencing and decarceration. And what better way to make a public example than with a case everyone remembers? The Menendez brothers have name recognition, controversy, and enough baggage to fill a courtroom. For opponents of Hochman's stance, this isn't just a legal argument, it's a PR campaign dressed up in legal robes. But regardless of motive, Hochman's opposition has real consequences. In court, his team showed no hesitation in using harsh visual tactics. At the April 11th hearing, they rolled out graphic photos from the crime scene, images that hadn't been seen publicly in decades. Blood-soaked carpets, bullet wounds, the sheer brutality of the crime. The message was clear. Don't forget what this is really about. Prosecutors leaned into their original narrative that this wasn't the act of frightened children trying to survive, but a calculated ambush while their parents sat on the couch watching TV. Garagos, defending the brothers, accused the DA's team of using spectacle instead of substance. He called it political theater, designed to inflame rather than inform. But Hochman's office stood firm. The visuals were, they argued, necessary to remind the court of the magnitude of the crime, something that can get diluted when the focus shifts to letters, psychological theory, or post-conviction behavior. And that's where this story starts to overlap with another major front, the habeas corpus petition. This is a separate track from the resentencing hearing, where resentencing looks at the sentence itself and whether it still fits under current law. A habeas petition is a direct challenge to the conviction. The Menendez brothers' legal team filed theirs back in 2023 after newly discovered evidence emerged, evidence that wasn't available during their original trial in the 90s. Specifically, the team pointed to a letter Eric wrote in 1988 to his cousin, describing ongoing abuse by his father, as well as an affidavit from former Menudo band member Roy Rosselló, who alleged that José Menendez had sexually assaulted him as a teen. The argument is that this new information could have influenced a jury's decision, potentially leading to a different verdict, like manslaughter instead of first-degree murder. But again, Hochman's office responded with full force. In early 2025, his team submitted their opposition to the habeas petition, making it clear that they don't believe any of this new evidence changes the core facts of the case. According to them, even if José Menendez was abusive, it doesn't legally justify what Eric and Lyle did. The standard for self-defense, Hochman argues, is not just fear, it's imminent threat. And in their view, there was no immediate danger when the brothers loaded up their shotguns and opened fire. That legal standard is key. Because even in a world where everything the brothers say about their childhood is true, it doesn't automatically make the murders legally justifiable. That's the line Hochman is drawing. The abuse, if it happened, is tragic, but it doesn't excuse premeditated murder, especially not one committed when the victims were unarmed, seated, and unaware. This hardline stance has made Hochman a lightning rod. Some see him as the voice of reason in a legal landscape that's grown too lenient. Others see him as the embodiment of a justice system that refuses to evolve even in the face of new evidence. What's undeniable is that his position has reshaped the trajectory of this case. He's not just opposing one hearing. He's challenging the entire foundation on which the brothers' current legal efforts are built. And yet, despite the force of his opposition, the judge ruled that the resentencing hearing would still go forward. Hochman lost that round, but the battle is far from over. His office will be present in the courtroom during the April 17th to 18th hearing, arguing just as passionately, if not more so, that the Menendez brothers should stay exactly where they are. At the same time, the habeas petition sits in legal limbo, waiting for a ruling. And outside the courtroom, another front has quietly opened up, one that doesn't rely on legal filings, but instead asks a different kind of question. Not whether the law allows the brothers' release, but whether, in a broader sense, they deserve a second chance at life outside prison walls. It's not often that a decades-old murder case suddenly flips from courtroom drama to cultural conversation. But that's exactly what happened in the Menendez brothers' saga after two pieces of evidence surfaced, one a letter, the other a sworn affidavit, that reignited not just the legal battle, but the public's fascination with what really happened inside the Menendez home. For years, Eric and Lyle Menendez have maintained that the murders of their parents weren't about money, but fear. Fear of abuse. Fear that no one would help. Fear that the cycle would never end. And for just as long, that claim has been met with skepticism, often dismissed as a legal Hail Mary. But in 2023, something changed. That something came in the form of a handwritten letter dated 1988, months before the murders. Eric Menendez was 18 at the time. He had written to his cousin Andy Cano, confiding something dark and deeply personal. In the letter, Eric said, "It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. Every night I stay up." He didn't name names directly. He didn't outline every detail, but he didn't need to. For the defense team and for many who've followed this case, the implications were chillingly clear. The "it" Eric referred to was the alleged sexual abuse by his father, Jose Menendez. This letter had been sitting in a family storage box for years, unknown to the courts, unknown to the public. Andy Cano had died in the early 2000s. It wasn't until Cano's mother discovered the letter while sorting through old belongings that it finally made its way to Eric's legal team. And once it did, it became something the case had never had before. Contemporaneous evidence. Not a courtroom claim made years later. Not trial testimony from a defendant trying to save his own life. But a real-time document written in a teenager's handwriting confiding a secret he didn't feel safe enough to share with anyone else. So that alone would have been a major development. But then came the second revelation, one from outside the Menendez family altogether. In 2023, Roy Rosillo, a former member of the Latin boy band Menudo, came forward with his own allegations. In a sworn affidavit filed with the court, Rosillo alleged that Jose Menendez had sexually assaulted him multiple times in the early 1980s. According to Rosillo, it happened when he was just 14 or 15 years old. First during a visit to the Menendez home, and again before and after a Menudo performance at Radio City Music Hall. At the time, Jose Menendez was a high-powered executive in the music industry with ties to Menudo's label. He had access, he had influence, and according to Rosillo, he had used both to commit horrific acts. These were not vague secondhand stories. Rosillo gave dates, locations, and context, and while his claims had nothing to do with the murders directly, they served a powerful purpose. They provided independent, corroborating evidence that Jose Menendez may have engaged in a pattern of sexual abuse, one that stretched beyond his own children. It's that independence that changed the conversation. Because if Jose Menendez abused someone outside the family, then maybe, just maybe, the claims Eric and Lyle made from the witness stand weren't lies or legal strategy. Maybe they were the truth no one wanted to believe in 1993. For the Menendez brothers' legal team, this evidence became the bedrock of a habeas petition filed in 2023, arguing that if a jury had seen this letter and heard Rosillo's testimony, the outcome could have been drastically different. Maybe not a full acquittal, but perhaps a conviction on a lesser charge, manslaughter instead of first-degree murder. That petition is still working its way through the courts, but in the meantime, a new strategy has emerged. A different path. One that doesn't rely on a judge, but on a governor. In early 2025, California Governor Gavin Newsom took an unexpected but significant step. He ordered the state parole board to conduct a formal risk assessment on Lyle and Eric Menendez. This isn't a sentence reduction or a commutation. It's more of a diagnostic tool, an in-depth look at who these men are today, whether they've shown rehabilitation, and whether they pose any threat to the public if released. It's not a rubber stamp, and it's not quick. But it signals that the state is at least willing to consider clemency, something that had long been viewed as impossible in this case. The risk assessment involves interviews, psychological evaluations, and a review of disciplinary records from their decades in prison. And the results will matter. If the parole board determines the brothers are a low risk, it strengthens their case for clemency. If not, it could shut the door before it ever opens. The board is expected to complete its final report by June 13, 2025, at which point Newsom will decide whether to hold a clemency hearing. What's interesting about this phase of the story is how separate it is from the court battles, and yet how deeply connected it feels. While prosecutors are still arguing in court about the original motives, the state's executive branch is asking a different set of questions, not about what happened in 1989, but about who Eric and Lyle are now. Have they changed? Have they accepted responsibility? Have they been rehabilitated? And can society live with the idea of two notorious killers walking free after all this time? It's a heavy question. And it's not just being asked in government buildings. Social media has exploded with commentary, especially among younger audiences who weren't even born when the trial happened. The TikTok generation has taken a surprisingly deep interest in the case, poring over trial footage, dissecting the abuse claims, and in many cases, openly supporting the brothers' release. Some call it justice delayed. Others call it emotional manipulation. But no matter what side people fall on, the public attention is real. And it's reshaping how this case is perceived, even by those who once wrote it off as an open and shut act of greed and brutality. Documentaries and streaming specials have played their part too, with several revisiting the Menendez story through the lens of trauma and long-term abuse. For many viewers, these shows introduced Eric's letter and Rosella's affidavit for the first time. And once those details are out there, they're hard to unsee. The narrative that once seemed simple, two rich kids kill their parents for the money, suddenly looks more complicated, more layered, more uncomfortable. None of this guarantees clemency, of course. Governor Newsom hasn't tipped his hand, and District Attorney Hochman has already made it clear he opposes any efforts to reduce the brothers' sentences, whether it's through the courts or the governor's office. But the clemency process is real. It's active. And it's running on a timeline of its own, parallel to the resentencing and the habeas petition. So now the Menendez brothers have three lanes in motion: a resentencing hearing, a habeas challenge, and a clemency review. Any one of them could open the door, or all three could stall. But what's undeniable is that, for the first time in decades, the possibility of release is no longer just a theory. And that possibility rests on more than legal technicalities. It rests on the idea that truth evolves, that new evidence changes old perceptions, that a case we thought we understood may deserve another look, not because the crime was any less horrific, but because the story behind it might be more complex than we ever imagined. What happens next, whether in court or the governor's office, that will decide how this chapter ends. But in many ways, the final judgment isn't just about Eric and Lyle. It's about how we, as a society, process justice, accountability, and redemption in the long shadow of trauma.
He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.